bring me to your new little home, Bernie.
You're welcome.
Yeah, it's very nice. Okay, so let's start at the beginning. I know you are 93, 94, in December.
94, December the 3rd.
Wow. So what's your... So December the 3rd, what year were you born?
1924.
1924, wow. Wow, how amazing. This is what I love about this series, is just the contemplation of the time that... You know, you and my other guests were born, and what an unbelievably different world it was.
That's right. And I'm lucky that I can remember some of people like us, and especially the mentor, they can remember things back 50 years, 60, asking what they did 10 minutes ago.
They can't remember things.
So,
I know. It's sad, isn't it? What's your memory like? I know you're pretty sharp, but there's differences between short-term and long-term memory. What's your memory like?
What's my...
memory like?
Well, I'm slightly losing my occasionally, you know. Sometimes I'm trying to think of somebody's name and then I wake up in the middle of the night and I've got you.
Yeah, there it is!
But and my hearing's slightly going. Since I've come in here, actually.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know why. But anyhow...
But everything...
Other than my knees... I lift 210, I reckon.
210? What?
No, you're joking me.
Oh, right. but your knees have slightly...
Yes, they're arthritis in both knees.
Yeah.
And I can't... I couldn't cut the lawn and paint or do anything. I just sit in the chair. The only thing I do could... use the microwave because Ellen couldn't do any gardening.
Your wife couldn't, couldn't do the gardening, so that's yours.
She had a stroke, but it was a stroke. And then we got her to the hospital, and then direct from the hospital, they brought her here. She didn't bring her home, you see. So I was on my own for a couple of weeks, and then decided that it would be a good thing if, because as I say, 93. So I thought it would be a good idea to help Helen, you know. So.
Yes. How long have
we... She's all right today.
Is she... How old's Helen, you
are? Helen is 87.
Yeah.
And that's on the 5th of the 11th.
Don't forget.
31 she was born.
So 31.
You remember backward, you know.
Yeah. And how long have you guys been together? How long have you known each other?
Oh, this is our second marriage. I'd say the date's on there.
On the painting,
about 40-odd years, you know.
Well,
second marriage, you know.
Second. So how long was your first marriage?
About 25 years.
Wow. So you've done two marriages, 25 and 40 years.
Yeah.
Most people these days wouldn't be able to get to 25, certainly not 40, let alone doing both.
Well, you would not believe this, but when Lorna and
first wife
we sat around the table and it just came out and over a cup of tea, but because we bought... I was a migrant in the 50s.
Migrant, yeah.
You see? And
from England.
And I went to the picture show one night on my own.
Yeah.
And then this young lady was sitting on my left.
Yeah.
And I passed
out. In the theatre?
I passed out with hypothermia, you know.
Oh, God.
And, you know, hypertension. I'd been naughty at the time with that, but the manager comes, she said, oh, I'm a nurse. She was an army nurse, you know.
Yeah.
And took me outside, set me outside, gave me a couple of pills, and then got me to the doctor. And then from then on, we met for a while. And,
oh, my God.
But
you pass out in a movie theatre. Yeah,
but
the nurse...
what I'm trying to get at is we both worked. We moved out and we lived in East Marlborough.
Yeah.
And she got pregnant.
Yeah.
And
were you married already?
and a father and mother lived at Frankston.
Uh-huh.
And anyhow, while we was there, I'd met some English people, and they knew a chap who was involved in building and like architecture. There was an housing thing coming up at Seaholm, down in Altona.
Uh-huh.
And he asked me, would I like to be in it? And he said, you can get a block of land. I think it was about £85, because the wages wasn't what they are.
No.
So I did, and we built a house, got a loan off a bank, about $12,000 for the house. No, that was a lot of money.
Yeah.
But we both, and she was a nurse, as I say, and we had two boys, and we both worked all the time at the house, at work, and we both went to education. Well, both now, Gary's retired now, and he was the manager for the Pacific. For mobile and the oil and gas
division.
Matt is the boss now over in Perth in one of the companies over there. So they all did well.
Yeah.
And I think what happened, we were that busy building the house, going to education, we drifted apart. Became friends, not partners. And when I left, actually, the actual words, to be quite honest, was, well, she said, when do you think you may leave? I said, well, it depends on you. And she says, well, what's wrong with now?
Wow.
That simply is that.
Gosh.
And I wrote down, the house was all paid for by that time.
Yeah.
So I gave her the house on the one condition that it goes to Gary Mark on her passing.
Yeah.
And that was the end of that.
My God. But did you think you were in, now looking back, because you've obviously had a lot of life and another marriage, do you think that you were, like, how did you feel about her when you got married? Did you think you were really in love, or what did you think?
No, I wouldn't think. No, it was just, I think that we worked. Because she worked hard as a nurse, and I was working all the time. And one time there, I did a second job as a taxi driver.
But apart from like the jobs and stuff, like what, like was it?
I can't explain it, but it just seems to me that's what it was. It was involved too much in the material things.
I see.
And bringing up the kids. In fact, the only real argument we had, I came home one day and she had the two boys knitting. I said, my sons do not knit.
Really?
And that would be about the only argument we ever had. You know, I don't think it...
Why did she have them knitting? Because, I mean...
Well, I can't answer that.
I mean, I actually think it's a lovely thing, because I think these days there's less boundaries.
Probably she believed in woman equality.
So she was a bit ahead of her time.
I can't answer that.
No, but she was a bit ahead of her time in terms of maybe less kind of rigid about the stereotypes about boys and girls.
She was a good woman. She was a good wife and everything. But towards all those years and things and... I took up bowling, and at some time I was out a bit later than I should have been, and all those type of things.
Yeah.
So, as I said, we passed over a cup of tea.
Yeah. Wow, God, so that's amazing.
I got a flat in Frankston, and there was another thing. She didn't treat the eldest boy, Gary, very well. He was a prefect at the secondary school, and he with the boys, and there was a girl, I can't remember her name at the moment, and they was sort of going about. I used to lend like two cars then, and I used to lend him one, and she didn't like it, and she used to cause a lot of trouble. In fact, one day when at secondary school, Gary hadn't come home, And I said, well, I said, I don't know. So I went down. And I went to the school, and there he was asleep in the hall. He said his mother told him to get out.
Mm.
Now, that may have had something to do with it, you know.
Mm.
I said, well, you go home. And I'm a bit German too, you know. I'm not a pushover.
Mm.
So you go home. You tell your mother, I'm the boss.
Mm.
And I say, she can't time you out, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's about the only couple of words that I said before the women.
Yeah.
That's about it, you know. For that matter.
Sure.
And by the way, she passed away 3 weeks ago.
Three weeks ago?
91, but she's 91. And the boys, the youngest one, got a mark, lives in Perth. He comes up, he was responsible for everything. Because,
yeah.
And she's in a funeral request. I said, that's me. I said, well, naturally I can't go. It wouldn't be decent of me after 40 odd years to go. But I said, I'll send the wreath and things like that. And Gary said he would do the same. But in her will, which left the house to the boys.
Yeah.
Said that she wanted to make him and send him back to Tasmania and spread over her mother's grave. And that's what happened.
Ah, okay.
So you do what people want.
You were born in, did you say Lincolnshire?
Lincolnshire, Scotland, in a place called Gunness.
Gunness.
Which is near Kidby Bridge,
uh-huh.
Which is the crossing from Lincolnshire into Yorkshire.
I see.
My father, he was an hairdresser. He was in the First World War, and he was an hairdresser. He was a business, you know.
A hairdresser?
But we moved around a little bit.
Like a barber?
It was a barber.
Yes. Yeah.
And then we finished up living out at a place called Crowe, which is still in English here, but it was a farming area with only about 400 people, you know.
Yeah.
And we had a corner shop with accommodation, and that's where we lived, where my mother passed away. She had TB, you know, tuberculosis.
Tuberculosis, yeah.
She went into hospital. Was isolated. It's called the isolation hospital.
Yeah. How old was she when she died?
Now I have to figure it out now.
Well, how old were you? Do you remember how old you were?
I was about 11. And
that's young.
Yeah. And my younger brother, we had to go into a home, but. Somehow or other, they kept me there, and the lady in the house next door used to look after me.
So when your mother died, you had to go. So you had to be. You were taken sort of away from your father to live in.
I wasn't taken away. My younger brother was. He was 5 years younger.
And was that because your dad, you know, maybe couldn't cope with two kids and grieving?
He got on the booze a bit.
Which a lot of men did back then, didn't they?
He got on the boat a bit. He was wounded in the First War.
Was he?
That's why the army treated him for the wound and that made him a hairdresser, you know.
They gave him the skill to go on to be a hairdresser.
Yeah.
How was he wounded?
But anyhow, when I come 14... or in the village, and to go to either high school or tech school was 10 miles away. Well, it might have been 1,000 miles away because for the transport.
Yeah. How did you get there?
Well, I didn't.
Oh.
I come to that.
Oh, okay.
But we were a strong Methodist family because John and Charles Wesley was born in Hepworth, about 3 miles away.
Mm-hmm.
There was a founder of the Methodist Church, and most of the people were Methodists and were very strict. And Mr. Moore, he held a big manor farm. And during the school holidays, those kids used to work on farms, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, if I can get permission, Bernie can come and live with us.
Oh.
And that's what happened to me. Until I was 17 and I volunteered for the Navy.
Mm.
And that every young man at that time did. And then I was in the Navy.
So, sorry, just going back to your mum, like, you know, what I'm realizing about this series is a lot of people lost people to diseases that, you know, have been, you know, sorted out by the medical world, for want of a better way of saying it. Tuberculosis, obviously, TB, what was that? What were the effects of that disease? Like, how did it manifest itself with people?
I really can't tell
you. I can't remember, honestly. But it was a big one, wasn't it, that used to take people out?
She was allowed out once, and I remember...
While she was in isolation.
I used to work on the farms. All the farmers and butchers, I used to help them with, you know, bringing the cows and milking them to feed the pigs and things like that. And had a wheelbarrow with a spear. And this lady stood on the corner of the house, and it was my mother.
She just wanted to come and see you.
So my dad said, well, we'll get another house. We've got another house there called Eland, which is about maybe 4 or 5 miles away, but in a little bit more countryfied sort of thing. What it built in what was at one time a private block, an acre, you know. But she had to go back again, you know, and that's...
Was that the last time you saw her?
That was the last time I saw her. I remember I'd gone to bed and I heard a knock on the door and it was a policeman.
Saying she'd gone.
Say that she'd gotten and passed
up. Do you remember how you felt?
Well, not really. I can't. Well,
is it because... It's a long time ago.
I could cry that.
See, it's still all there.
Yeah, it's still there.
Yeah.
You never forget.
Oh, I'm so sorry. And you know...
That's life. Yeah.
But, well, it's interesting that you say that because you're making me cry because I actually lost my father on Good Friday.
Yeah.
And I'm very aware now of, I guess, grief and...
Yeah.
It's very interesting seeing your reaction to, obviously, the death of your mother, 70... Did you say 74? Or, you know, 70... No, maybe 80... 84 years ago?
Well, I was 11.
Yeah, so you're 93.
I'm 93 now.
Yeah. So because people... I've been trying to grapple with the concept of when will the sadness pass? Because it's really only been in a month.
Yeah.
And people sort of, you know, there's a lot of people that say, well, you know, time will heal and all of that sort of stuff. But then there's a lot of people and mostly people that have lost someone significant that actually say that it actually never, the sadness never goes away.
Yeah.
And I guess you've just proven to me that it's very hard, isn't it?
Yeah. But I was well looked after.
That's good.
Mr. Moore and the public around me, they used to be, in those days, it wasn't Boy Scouts, it was a Boys Brigade, and I belonged to it from the Methodist Church and mixed with other children.
Yeah.
Harvest Home, what Americans call Thanksgiving, they got that from the farmers in Britain, who every year when all the crops were in, a Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
The Methodists had one, the Salvation had one, the Catholic Church had one, the Presbyterian had one.
Yeah.
On different days, but we all went to each other's.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And then one of the farmers on the Methodist, up at the Grange, big farm, and... he used to take us all down there and a great big monster shed and it all laid out with food and there was games and running and it was a good place.
There was, you know, something that I think existed when you were a child that exists a lot less now is, you know, a lot of groups that were organised within the community to entertain children, to even just a lot of church-related events that people all went to, which gave that sort of connect connection within the community that doesn't exist as much anymore.
The biggest difference I see myself, the lady you just spoke, I am the most independent person she's ever met.
Really?
Because I...
Because you had to start out on your own.
I do it myself. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I'm don't rely on anyone.
But it's like the girl coming to make the bed say, or coming for like, no, I'll do it myself. You're doing plenty, you know?
But that's also very...
But what it makes, makes you stronger... Makes you stronger, but sometimes, maybe too strong, I don't know, but I'm very independent.
We just celebrated the 100th anniversary of Anzac Day.
Yeah.
And I know we were talking earlier about that you were there in Spencer Street celebrating that. I kind of did my calculations, and I'm never very good at them, but 74-odd years ago was the D-Day landing, which you were part of.
Yeah.
See, that's
kind of... Yeah, well, just a little bit before that, I was on a destroyer on Russian convoys, and we got torpedoed in the Arctic, south of Bear Island, and I got out of it, and
So you were.
I was a survivor off that destroyer, brought back to Royal Naval Barracks in Plymouth. Which really we if you're a naval man, it's called guts, you know.
You were on Russian envoys, you were following Russian envoys?
No, I was escorting an American convoy to Murmansk.
Oh, okay, right.
That's what we did. We were stationed in Scapaflow, which is an island just north of Scotland.
Oh, and so you were protecting them as they were on their journey.
We did that quite a lot.
And so you got torpedoed by... Did you say the
German submarine?
German
submarine. The first time they used to attack it in single, the first time they had packed submarines, but they had, for during the first part of the war, there was they fired a figure of three submarines at torpedoes. But these torpedoes, they call them acoustic, and they follow the vibration of your propellers, what we call screws.
Yeah.
So the only way to stop that was to be stopped dead.
So they couldn't pick up on the vibration.
Or be over 25 knots. But the convoy that you're protecting has one speed, and that's the speed of the slowest ship, which is sometimes 8 knots, 10 knots. So we zigzag. Yeah, so...
Wow.
That's the way it was, anyhow.
But
anyhow, coming back to what you were saying.
Yeah.
I come back to Plymouth.
Wait, no, hang on. I just want to ask you about that, the submarine and the torpedoes, because I was talking to someone recently about just the concept of being, as you would have been in many of your roles in your naval days.
Yeah.
But the concept of being on a ship and never knowing when there is a submarine heading towards you and sending a torpedo.
Yeah,
was that like?
They had the Aztec, you know, which for echoes under the water and everything like that, you know.
Yeah.
But sometimes the submarines used to go under a merchant ship and stay underneath the merchant ship. And coming like that, you know, you wouldn't know they were there.
Oh my God.
By the way, I'm talking, I'm talking about winter. You're talking about nearly 24-hour darkness, not brightness. It's in the winter. You never had these big convoys like that in the summer, because going past North Cape, which is northernmost post of Norway.
Yeah.
To get round to Murmansk, to get down to Kola Inlet and the White Sea, and then the distance between that, you're not far for them to fly, and Germany had taken over all that. So during daylight,
they'd
be bombed to places, you know. So, but the Americans really put some money into Soviet with convoy, you know. So, yeah. No,
so,
but it was a winter's job. It was mostly to carry in stuff. I was going on duty. I had the morning watch, which starts at 0400. You get a shake at 0330.
Yeah.
And I was on Elmsman on that for the next watch. And it just happens, and that's it, you know.
So when you got hit,
yeah,
and you say you survived, what happened? Well, like, what do you remember of having suddenly, like, the boat is, like, knocked over?
Actually, I can tell you what I know, and there's a lot I can't tell you.
Yeah.
But as I said, I was the helmsman, the quartermaster, if I'd been in harbour, but helmsman at sea.
Yeah. Up the
and
front.
And each quartermaster had a bosun's mate. And he was in the wheelhouse with you, and he relayed all the daily orders that was mastered by the first lieutenant, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And Takato was his name. And he was the man who shook me at 3:30 in the morning. And I hung my hammock in the canteen, near the canteen.
Your hammock?
Where
you slept?
It was near the hammock.
Yep.
And it was a place where it was private, like this bit.
Yeah.
And I could get in and out, or just leave it
out of the way.
And we walked away, and we were going down the gangway when the ship seemed to lift up.
Whoa.
And met me on the bottom, right, my bottom went down beneath it, and then flung me on the wall, on the deck, on the side.
Yeah.
And poor old Carter, he didn't survive. But
he would have smashed his head.
I didn't know that for a while, because when I came round, there wasn't a sound. I went down the passage, the transmitting station was there, looked in there, nobody in there. Up the stairs towards through the mess deck, well, officer's mess deck, which leads to the wheelhouse. Nobody there.
Oh my God.
Nobody.
Could you see what you couldn't
nobody
see?
Nobody in the wheelhouse.
You just couldn't see them at all, not like bodies or anything.
No, so I didn't know where anybody was.
Oh my God, how weird.
So anyhow, I did hear voices on two decks above them, and my point of in that type of disaster was a cauliflower, like a big rubber
thing. Oh, okay. So what was your role? What did you have to do?
It was lashed. And this is where I'm coming. This is the funny bit. It's lashed to the side of the ship's wall.
Yeah.
Bulkhead. And it was about, I don't know, probably 10 other sailors stood there. And not one of them had a knife. And everybody in the Navy is issued with a knife.
Oh, God.
With one, it's not with a big blade on, and another one for when you're splicing rope, you know.
To get the rope.
But I had a knife, would you believe it? And I was absolutely wrong, because I was forbidden to wear a knife in the wheelhouse because it affects the magnetic compass. And that's the first time I ever wore that knife.
Wow.
There's something in there somewhere, you know.
Yeah, you were meant to have it.
Yeah.
You were meant to. So how many people on the boat died?
Oh, anyway, got it down.
Yeah.
And I got a line, And I tied it, secured it to the gunrail.
Yeah.
And then one chap got another ladder to go down.
Yeah.
By the way, looking down from the ship's side, you couldn't see the water. All you could see was a black,
wow, black
pit.
Oh, God. So you didn't even know what you were putting it down into.
I got to the bottom, and I jumped, and I missed the damn thing, and fell over it with my legs just
straddling it
above the knees in the water.
Oh,
and then they pipe, and in the Navy, you always obey the last order.
Mm-hmm.
And that order, when one was abandon ship,
yeah,
the next one was belay the last order, which means
is you forget the last order.
All of this went, and by this time, I got back out. And then all hands was mustering on the forecastle, and the ship's about 30 feet of the bow is out of the water because we're hitting the stern.
And
HMS Venus, which was our second in charge ship, it'd taken off one lot of sailors.
Yeah.
As it went by, they jumped onto it. Slowly, very slowly.
Yeah.
And then he went around, and then by the time I got there, the chief, I can't remember the chief master's name, we threw some life jackets over the side, but you couldn't see where you could hear voices.
It'd be like being in a bad dream.
You could hear the voices, but you couldn't see them.
Yeah.
And then somebody said, you better get on the ship, you know. And it was Virago. That's another one. We were the destroyer flotilla, B-26, you see. And instead of coming alongside and hit his head on, seemed to shove us further out. So they said, well, you better get out of the way. And they brought Venus back.
Yeah.
And he came alongside beautifully, and that's how I got away.
Wow. And you and how many others?
We lost about 49 men. I was all right, physically all right. It was a bit cold, but
I can imagine.
But it took the pants off, you get warm. Anyhow, but one officer said that. But even call me Bernie, no, it would have been Jackson.
Because you'd had such a big moment together.
Yeah, this one lad, and they got blankets over him to rub him, to bring, you know that.
So where did you spend that night? Venus.
On the Venus, the two. We'd taken our convoy through, we went back to this one, and they took us back to down Coleridge, which is about 30 miles down the inlet, it's called Coleridge, and then on the bottom is a river, I forget the name of the river, it's that where Murmansk is 12 miles down the river, and we was in Wrangell Hospital, and then from there, I came back on HMS Savage, to Scapa Flow.
So after an incident like that where you've lost 49, of your men, you've been hit by a torpedo, you've had a pretty terrifying kind of incident of rescue and, not knowing where you are, do you then get a period of time off where you're supposed to recover, like mentally and physically, or like how soon are you back on duties, that is, at a different location or different ship? What happened?
To be quite honest, your training in the Navy was good. And
to harden you up to it.
And it's like if you're in action, you're firing like they're firing, can't they? And you're doing your job. And until you hit.
Yeah.
You're normal.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
but it's not something that when it's gone, it's gone, sort of thing. It's sort of a memory, you know.
Now, it's with utmost respect, I am interrupting this beautiful conversation now for a moment to thank my sponsors, Freedom Aged Care. So when I decided to do this podcast series, which really came from a genuine place of feeling like the one generation in our society being talked about the least was actually the one we needed to be listening to because these people have lived so much. So I decided to give an aged care company a go, and I chose one that I'd explored during my search to find somewhere for my dad to live. And I instantly loved what Freedom appeared to be about, which was celebrating the lives of their residents, but doing it with a really joyful touch. And I contacted a guy called Craig Flett, who's one of the family members involved with Freedom Aged Care, a guy I'd never met. And in an email, I poured my heart out on why I wanted to do this series. And to my great surprise, he instantly said he wanted to get on board. As he put it, Freedom's residents have together lived a million years of life, a fact that the company is really intensely proud of. So it's become a really beautiful, authentic union, and it's allowed me to get paid for what I love doing, and for them, hopefully it highlights their commitment to honouring the people who have led long, brave and interesting lives, and people who deserve not to be forgotten. So now, back to my wonderful guest.
So you were part of the D-Day landings, which was...
So coming off that ship, I'll come back to Plymouth, to Guz, on light duties, mainly clothes, all right. And then the drafting office, name, BJ, and report, drafting office, sent me up from Plymouth to Scapa Flow to join the Rodney. And I've only been on there a few days when we set off. To see.
For Normandy?
No. But we wondered where... We was up there for one reason, was for the Turpis. It was over in in Norway. I don't know if you've heard of the Turpis and the Bismarck.
No.
But they were there. Two of the finest ships that were built.
Right.
But Rodney was one of them who helped build the Bismarck. But anyhow, we turned south because you're on the wheelhouse, you've got the compass. You know which way you're going.
Yeah.
If the compass says S, you're going south, you know.
Yeah.
And we're coming to Greenock, which is a river in Scotland, a shipbuilding area.
Yeah.
And a big harbour. The harbour was full. And a little man come on board. Montgomery. General Montgomery, and cleared the lower deck. When cleared, it means everybody on top. And he gave us a speech, didn't say exactly
what was happening.
What would D-Day? He spoke with strength, you know.
Yeah.
And he said, now we all got to work together, the Air Force, Navy, Army, every civilians. Said, I'm going to need you blokes shortly. But we knew it was D-Day coming up. But we didn't know it wasn't June the 6th, D-Day normally. It was June the 5th, should have been D-Day.
What?
And this is summer in Britain, by the way.
Yeah.
And it was cancelled for 24 hours because the weather was that bad.
Really?
It was,
They were going to do the invasion on the 5th.
All these blokes are waiting to go on. Like, for instance, an aircraft, they had to have more than 50% clearance of sky.
Yeah. So they had to wait 24 hours.
All that type of thing, you know. And lots of the chaps on the landing craft were seasick.
Oh, God.
I've never been to sea before, you know, and things like that, you know. That was the start of the day.
So your understanding after that man's speech...
Rodney itself, we were at sea, escorted down to Greenock, then we were escorted down to the English Channel, and by this time it's dark, and that was June the 4th, because D-Day was supposed to be...
The next 7 day.
7 o'clock. On the 5th. I don't know where, we were somewhere in the area, but I couldn't tell you where, you know. And the captain, he broadcast that this there was a delay of 24 hours because of the weather conditions, and we will be notified. He said, from now on, the Padre will keep you in touch. He said, he was, you know, a busy man, the captain, of course. And the Padre, I forget what time, but it come the 5th, and he said, come the 6th of June.
Yeah.
To this moment, we have not heard one word. We will assume that it is the day. And it was.
Oh my God! So, what was your understanding at that point of D-Day? It was literally you knew that it was going to be
the point of D-Day was naturally not just to relieve France.
Mm.
It was a sort of a three-pronged area. They started with the Boers winning in North Africa, all the British troops, then they fought over the Sicily into Italy, Europe to Italy. The Russians. Daly was fighting from Sebastopol to right up north of St. Petersburg, which is 2,000 miles front. Mm. And they wanted an invasion 2 years before it actually happened.
Mm.
And the Americans at that time volunteered one division. When we attacked them, Germans had 65 divisions. And they'd already sent 12 the Russians, but it was a triangle,
a triangle approach to merge.
To finish the war.
Yeah, to finish the war.
Well,
it's like a last ditch attempt. Yeah,
and of course, the French people themselves, they blew bridges up, things to stop the Germans getting out and all this type of thing. I forget what they call them. Like a free French army kind of thing, you know. But it was the thing about it, why it stands out, is because it was the biggest amphibious landing in history.
Yes.
And of course, I think from now on, we'll always stand to be because of the H-bomb now, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So 5,000 ships is a lot of ships.
How were you all feeling? Like, were you feeling
about
like...
10,000 planes.
It's hard.
In 3 weeks, we had 3 million men in France.
It's just unbelievable.
And they even built a pipeline from the Isle of Wight to Cherbourg, and that's under the English Channel to take all of that. And that's another thing. We even bombed some of our own country. We finished D-Day. D-Day count from June the 6th to about 26th of August. That's in that span, that's when you qualify for the D-Day medal, you know?
I see.
But what Caen, C-A-E-N, was the town. It was supposed to be captured on D-Day, which is 11 miles from the channel.
Yeah.
But they didn't. For a couple of months, sort of thing, you know.
Did you think you were gonna win?
Then they said, we're off home. They told us out because of mines, still mines and everything, you know. But we didn't go out. They took us to Cherbourg, and all in the island. You heard, I don't know if you heard of the Channel Islands.
Yes.
Well, all in the island. The German big guns were shelling into Cherbourg, the ships coming in. So I've got a bit of paper there somewhere. When we fired 16 from the 16-inch guns, which each shell weighed a ton and a third, and pull them all out of action, and then we come back to Plymouth. That was the end of the day for us.
That was it. Wow. Mm-hmm. How do you look back at that time, like now? Do you look back at it differently and think, whoa, that was more overwhelming than I realized?
There are many ways of looking at it. And a simple thing for me to explain is I was a centre gun layer of a 16-inch gun in a turret with 24... 24-inch still. I said, yeah, I saw nothing.
Right.
I learned this story, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But there is one story I would like to tell you.
Yeah.
The Americans sent troops over, and there was that one of their beaches was Utah, which is near Sherbourne.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was they bought 30,000 acres of land. The government actually took it off the farmer because it was simplified to the same land as it was around Utah,
mm-hmm.
and trained them. And one night they sent out so many landing craft with one destroyer escort, and out of Cherbourg come these German E-boats, and they could do about 50 knots. They carried two torpedoes. And 95 young American lads died.
Oh, God.
And the old boys never got a medal. Well, the parents.
Wow.
Oof. There's a million stories you can tell that'll never be told.
No. Does any of that time come back to you in your dreams? Does any of that sort of... do you have... Good, bad dreams.
That day, you know, when you're... The funny thing about it, until we meet somebody like you...
Yeah.
You never find...
You're not thinking about it.
No, they don't talk about it. No. About the good times.
That's... Yes, you never reflect.
You just say, what ship was you said, oh, Rodney, what ship was it? Oh, I was on the Devonshire, I was on this, yeah. I was on that, I was on that. But they don't win.
You don't go into all the detail.
It's... What happened to all.
I'd like to thank Freedom Aged Care for introducing me to some of its wonderful residents for this series, who together have lived a million years of life. To find out more about Freedom Aged Care, head to freedomagedcare.com.au.